podcasting technology of normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Wednesday, June the 20th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal so that we can stop the senseless prohibition of marijuana today in America. Just visit NORML.org to get involved with legalization today. Today on the program, we'll have a special segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine from State University of New York. Mitch is author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. Mitch is a great psychologist and researcher who has a lot of experience with a variety of things. Today, we're going to have a special segment about why marijuana is safer than alcohol and some of the dangers about alcohol, especially for young people. Summertime, it's sort of that time when a lot of people experiment with different things out there, but marijuana is certainly safer than alcohol, and we'll find out just how dangerous alcohol is in our segment with Mitch today. We have breaking news today from Connecticut. That's coming up here in just a moment. Tomorrow on the program, we'll speak with Doug McVeigh and Kevin Zeese from Common Sense for Drug Policy. They run a number of excellent websites that are wonderful resources for marijuana and other drug policy information. And while we have breaking news on Connecticut today, next Tuesday in our Government at Work segment, we'll speak with Lorenzo Jones from A Better Way Foundation in Connecticut, and also with the Connecticut Nurses Association and others about what happened there in Connecticut today. But let's get to that story right now. Here's breaking news from Normal. Breaking news today from Hartford, Connecticut. Connecticut governor's veto means arrest and jail for state's medical marijuana patients. Republican Governor M. Jody Rell vetoed legislation this week that would have enacted statewide legal protections for authorized patients who use medical cannabis under a doctor's supervision. House Bill 6715 sought to allow state registered patients to possess and cultivate small quantities of cannabis for therapeutic purposes. House lawmakers had previously approved the bill by an 89-58 margin. State senators had voted 23-13 in favor of the proposal. The Connecticut Nurses Association, as well as the Connecticut Black and Latino Caucus, also endorsed the bill. If enacted, Connecticut would have been the 13th state since 1996 to implement statewide legislation protecting patients from prosecution for their use of medical cannabis. In her veto message, Governor Rell, herself a cancer survivor, said that passing the bill would send, quote, the wrong message, close quote, to young people. Rell further claimed that, quote, no clinical trials, close quote, had been performed to establish the efficacy of medical cannabis and that, quote, legal alternatives, close quote, to cannabis are available to patients by prescription. The governor also claimed that the bill would potentially place patients, quote, in legal jeopardy by encouraging them to purchase, plant, or grow marijuana in violation of federal law, close quote. Normal senior policy analyst Paul Armentano, a Connecticut native, called the governor's comments cynical and insincere.
Governor Rell's supposed concerns for patients' well-being ring hollow. The governor is well aware that federal prosecutions for state-authorized medical marijuana patients are exceedingly rare, even in states like California, where it's estimated that several hundred thousand patients are currently using cannabis with their doctor's approval. Ironically, Governor Rell's veto assures that the state and local police can keep arresting Connecticut patients so the feds won't have to.
Under state law, Governor Rell had the option of allowing HB 6715 to become law without her signature. According to a 2004 University of Connecticut poll, 83% of state voters support the use of medical cannabis when authorized by a physician. Joining us today is the director of the State Organizing and Policies Project at the Drug Policy Alliance, Gabriel Saya. His office helped bring this issue forward in Connecticut. Gabriel's appeared here on the program as a frequent guest in our legislative coverage on the Audio Stash. Gabriel, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks, Chris.
Now, Governor Rell vetoed the legislation today. I have to ask, was this a surprise? I know she's been silent on the subject for a few weeks now.
I can't say that we were surprised completely. We never had full indication that she would sign the bill. She had been evasive throughout the legislative session from January on, and she certainly made a number of, to use a familiar term, flip-flopping types of statements over the last 6 months that indicated that she was not supportive of the legislation. She seemed to be trying to grasping for straws. That was very clear on ways that she could legitimately veto this bill. Her opposition early on was about, well, it's not only related to terminally ill patients, and then it was, well, it's going to send a wrong message to young people, and then it was, well, what about the first seed issue? With every one of those statements that she made, we would respond with available research and data that had showed that it doesn't actually have an impact on youth in the detrimental ways that they would argue, and in fact, in medical marijuana states, marijuana use amongst teenagers have actually gone down. We had patients calling her about the terminally ill issue. The first seed issue is always something that comes up that we've addressed, and that does exist in this certain gray area, and we say, look, we're actually just trying to protect patients here. So, every time she brought up something, we had a response to it, and then she would change what her opposition was. And in the end, what seems pretty clear is that she took a page right out of the Bush playbook. She must have gotten a call from Washington and is just following, the Bush administration line on this.
Now, last year we saw the Rhode Island legislature overturn the governor's veto there and make their medical marijuana bill into law. Is that a possibility in Connecticut? Could the legislature reconvene and overturn Rell's veto?
Unfortunately, it's not. Connecticut does have that option. The legislature could come back into a special session and override a veto of the governor. But we're not going to see that happen with this bill, unfortunately. Even though we had really extraordinary margins of support within the state legislature, it wasn't enough. It was just shy of having veto-proof margins. And so the opportunity for us to do an override here is just, we're just short of the needed votes to obtain that.
Now, Gabriel, there really was an incredible amount of support for medical marijuana access in Connecticut. The Nurses Association, the State Senate, and House, both legislative bodies, passed this by very strong margins. There was even religious support, and then polling showed over 80% of the residents were in support of medical access as well.
Yeah, that's right. What's really clear here is that we didn't lose for lack of support in the state of Connecticut or for lack of effort. Dozens and dozens of religious and medical and legal and community organizations supported this legislation. We had literally hundreds of phone calls and letters being sent to the governor, phone calls being made every day for 2 weeks straight from doctors and patients and community members and family members and so forth. We had, the 83% of the population supported medical marijuana, according to the University of Connecticut poll that was done not too long ago. And then we had experts and religious and medical and legal experts from around the country, very prominent people, who were also sending messages to the governor saying, hey, this is the right thing to do. You should sign this bill. We had people up at her office meeting with her. We had people holding vigils outside of her office. We held press conferences. We did lobby days. We did community conversations around this. We had, you know, historic bipartisan coalitions with conservative Republicans and members of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus meeting with the governor's staff. I mean, we really went the distance on this one, and it certainly was not for lack of effort or lack of support within the state that she vetoed this bill. This is one of the difficult things to swallow, is that this is a purely political decision. If it was based on the merits, if she was vetoing this bill based on the merits, you know, if it was about the fact that it didn't only address terminally ill patients or something related to young people or other issues, we were open to dealing with those or at least having a discussion with the governor. We made that absolutely clear to her from January onwards that, hey, if you've got reservations on this bill, let's sit down and talk about it. She had ample opportunity to step forward and say, hey, these are some of the things that I'd like to see changed, and, you know, if those can be addressed, then I'll support this legislation. She never did that. And by not doing that, it's an indication that it's a political choice, not a choice based on the merits of the legislation, which ultimately means it really wouldn't have mattered what we have done, because we did just about everything. This was a political choice that was made, and if you read her veto message that's posted on her website, you may as well be reading something that was scripted directly out of the drug czar's office, because they are the exact same arguments that the drug czar has been making against medical marijuana for the past number of years. And those arguments are completely untenable. They're not based in science. They're certainly not based in reason or logic. And they're just completely devoid of any compassion.
And do you think this veto is going to have a broader political backlash, a negative one, against Governor Rell in her future? I mean, going against so much of the state on an issue like this.
Oh, absolutely. Because where now does it leave the residents of Connecticut, you know, not only the patients, but residents in general? I mean, if the governor is saying that she will not provide, by signing this bill, she will not provide, or by not signing it, rather, she's not going to provide legal protections to Connecticut residents that would protect patients, cancer patients, HIV and AIDS patients, people with debilitating spinal cord injuries and others, multiple sclerosis, if she's not going to protect those people from arrest and prosecution when they're trying to seek relief for dealing with their conditions, then where really are we supposed to go here? I mean, why shouldn't we be making a larger demand then? I mean, this is a no-brainer, Chris. You know, and I'm sure many of your listeners will feel this way. This was a no-brainer. This was a very, very simple issue to support here. Hey, let's just not arrest patients. Let's let doctors make a recommendation to their patients if they think marijuana will be useful. Let those patients obtain and use that marijuana without the threat of prosecution and arrest and prosecution and incarceration. That's a no-brainer. By vetoing this bill, essentially what the governor has done, not only has she aligned herself with the most unsuccessful and hated, you know, presidential administration in history, one that no other Republican in the country practically, except the most lunatic fringes, are still trying to associate themselves with, which is the Bush administration. But she has also essentially said to Connecticut, sorry, even though everybody in our state supports this, I'm not going to support it, and I'm going to allow patients to continue to be arrested and incarcerated. I think that she has just painted herself into a very dark corner, and I think that the political ramifications and the setbacks that she's going to face are going to be severe. And I'll tell you, I know that many of our allies and our constituent allies and the people that we've been working with in the campaign over the past year, we're seeing these responses come in. People are furious, absolutely furious. And I think that there is going to be a conversation about the war on drugs in Connecticut, that as a result of this veto, we're going to see political demands being made that I think Governor Rell is going to have a very, very tough time dealing with over the course of the next year.
Righto. Well, Gabriel, thank you for joining us today to weigh in on this, and keep up the great work there. I do look forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate you having us on again.
Thank you again. Gabriel Saya is the director of the State Organizing and Policies Project at the Drug Policy Alliance. You can find them online at drugpolicy.org.
What's up, guys? This is Ms. High Times 2007, and you're chilling with us here at the Normal Podcast.
Wednesdays here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to speak with Dr. Mitch Earlywine about the science of cannabis. Mitch is professor of psychology at State University of New York, author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and he's editor of the new book, Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Today in our segment, we're going to explore a more dangerous and legal recreational intoxicant, alcohol. Especially in terms of how young people consume alcohol today. Normal, Safer, and other groups are educating the public that marijuana is significantly less harmful than alcohol, and teenagers especially use alcohol at much, much higher rates than marijuana. Mitch has a history of research dealing with alcohol, and we've explored the issue here on the Audio Stash with him before, but now that everyone is home from college and out on summer vacation, it's important to look at the issue again and in terms of youth consumption. Mitch, welcome back here to the Audio Stash today. It's always great to speak with you.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Hey, Mitch, it's always great to have you here on the program. Now, we all know that marijuana essentially is non-toxic and a far, far safer substance than alcohol, tobacco, most prescription drugs, even over-the-counter pain medications like ibuprofen or acetaminophen. Marijuana is certainly the least harmful of any of those things. When I was on the CDC, the Center for Disease Control's website this week, and visited their alcohol section, I was stunned by some of the data presented there about young people's consumption of alcohol. You know, about half of all high schoolers admitted drinking alcohol, and almost 20% said that they had a binge drinking experience in the last year. This is 14 to 17 year olds. Now, this is far more than the 20% or so of high schoolers in the same group that admit having tried marijuana once. So consuming alcohol, this is a particularly risky behavior for teens in regard to their health, I know, but what makes it so dangerous for teens to drink, especially binge drink?
The bottom line is it's very hard to monitor your dosage with alcohol, particularly when you're not a very experienced drinker. So the definition of binge is usually 5 standard drinks for a man or 4 for a woman in a single drinking episode. And I think teens in particular sort of misestimate what a standard drink is. So a single beer or a 1.5-ounce shot of 80-proof liquor or 5 ounces of wine, which usually isn't the, you know, drink of choice for most teens, that's a drink. So, you know, I get teens coming to me saying, oh, I only had 2 drinks, I don't know what happened, and I find out they had 2 8-ounce tumblers of vodka. You know, it's clearly not 2 drinks. So just keeping that standard drink notion in mind, I think, is particularly important. Unfortunately, alcohol is really impairing when it comes to the good old inhibitory functions. So, of course, we don't want to see anybody drink and drive, but particularly if you're inexperienced in other domains, you tend to get disinhibited and, you know, you're not particularly at your best for things like, God forbid, putting on a condom or just handling interpersonal strife or anything along those lines. I find that the summer is particularly a rough time for this because of a number of different things that contribute. An empty stomach, for one thing. People seem to kind of lose their appetites a bit in the summer and don't eat as much and end up drinking on an empty stomach and getting the alcohol absorbed a whole lot. They often drink alcohol when they're dehydrated in the first place and end up really severely dehydrated, and you know how rough that can be and can, you know, land you in the emergency room. Indeed. And then the mixers that we use in the summer tend to be carbonated, and people thought it was just an urban legend, but in truth, a carbonated beverage works on the pylorus sphincter, works on an area where things are opening up to get to your stomach, and actually makes it open more rapidly because those little bubbles are kind of beating on it, if you will, saying, hey, open up, let me in. And suddenly the alcohol gets poured down into the stomach markedly more rapidly, and that turns into a big, big rise in blood alcohol concentration. And as Chris Martin and I showed in the early 90s, the faster you get that alcohol in there, the more dramatic the effects, and that's when people can really lose their minds on this drug.
Now, the prevalence of teen drinking was a surprise to me, Mitch. I guess I spent too much time looking at marijuana data, and the number of teens trying pot, again, far, far fewer than those trying alcohol. But according to the CDC, Center for Disease Control, 61% of American adults drink alcohol, but 43% of high school kids, grades 9 through 12, that's how many are trying it. That's a lot. I mean, every state has over 21 laws for alcohol sales, zero tolerance, drunk driving laws for those under 21, and still young people are drinking at those very high rates. Is it just that we focus too much on preventing things like marijuana smoking? We don't try to stop teen drinking enough, and that drinking is accepted as part of our culture.
It's hard to test this just in a single country, but it looks like because we've drawn this line between legal and illegal, people may have misinterpreted that. Also, alcohol has been a rite of passage here in the U.S. for literally 200 years. I find when you go to visit, you know, Europe and places where people are trained to drink with their families, if you will, so in Italy where everybody, you know, has a little glass of wine at dinner at almost any age, and where intoxication and drunkenness is really frowned upon, you find people learn how to drink, and they get some training in that in the sense that you would learn how to do anything else. Because it's so prohibited here in the U.S., and there's this wild forbidden fruit, oh, I'm going to act like an adult thing going on, kids get it. They know they may not have a whole lot of time with it. They don't want to get busted with it, so they end up chugging all the alcohol they can in very little time. And that's, of course, a really, really bad way to drink as far as negative consequences are concerned.
And perhaps, you know, one of the more enlightening pieces of data at the CDC is that over 30% of teens say that even if they didn't drink themselves, they were in a car with a fellow teenager behind the wheel who had been drinking. Now, we already know that alcohol causes almost 50,000 highway road fatalities each year directly from alcohol. But, you know, how do we get young people to realize that this is really the most dangerous situation to be in, is to be in a car with an alcohol-intoxicated teenager behind the wheel?
Right. There are several things that we actually have empirical support for, hey, this really does work. First and foremost, making it okay to say, hey, I'm not ready to drive yet. So if you're at a party with somebody and that person's supposed to drive and you know that person's been drinking, just saying, hey, do you want to hang out for a couple more hours? Why don't you quit drinking and let's have some water, you know, let's get rehydrated and give you the chance to metabolize. That can be a very big, important step. Now, I know I'm supposed to jump up and down and say they should never drink and they should never drink and drive and stuff like that. Hey, I was a teenager, too. It wasn't completely ancient history. But the idea that I'm going to wait longer, I know I'm going to be leaving soon, so I'm going to give myself time to metabolize a little bit, is really going to be adaptive. God forbid you limit yourself to two drinks, you know? Hey, have two drinks, make them as pleasant as possible, and in truth, you'll get more enjoyment, less hangover, less of the sedative negative effects of alcohol, more of the fun, lighter ones under those circumstances. But if you're 21, if you're under 21, you're breaking the law, and you're risking getting busted in so many domains. That's already going to be a problem. The other thing is, I think teens tend to overestimate how infuriated their parents are going to be if they get a call saying, come pick me up. No parent wants a child to drive after drinking, period. I mean, sure, it's inconvenient to get a call at 1 o'clock in the morning saying, come pick me up, but it's a lot more inconvenient getting a call from the police saying, I just pulled your son over and he's drunk, and God forbid, you know, you get a call saying your son has just had an intoxicated accident or daughter, and, you know, that's just beyond any parent's comprehension. It's just really, really hard to even fathom. So call, you know, you take your whip and you get it a little bit yelled at, but it's so much better than anything else. The other thing is that if you, you know, prep your parents a little bit, say, hey, I'm going to a party tonight. I may be giving you a call later. I realize you open yourself up to some critiques, but at least you're giving them the prime. You're saying, okay, this potential. Having a designated driver works incredibly well in a whole bunch of different domains as well. And there's always that one person who really probably doesn't want to drink anyway. So why not make that person designated driver and let them be, you know, your best friend for the night. And then, hey, you really owe them one.
And Mitch, how much does peer pressure come into play here when it comes to teen drinking? You know, do people do this on their own, or is it peer pressure? You mentioned drinking as a rite of passage in America, but it sounds like most of these teens are not drinking with an adult out there.
It's funny because parents love the peer pressure argument because it's not my kid who's doing it. It's all those other evil ones who are making them do it. The peer pressure isn't as flagrant as it is in the movies. Nobody's saying, here, chug this or I'm going to beat your head in. It's, hey, everybody else is doing this and looks like they're having a good time. I would like to have a good time too. And often it's more that modeling aspect than anything else. What's funny, too, is we've seen this in social psychology time and again. In one big group, if just one person will go in the opposite direction, then other people will, too. So if one person is the first person to say, hey, I'm actually not going to drink tonight, then suddenly other people are like, oh, God, I'm so relieved. Somebody's not drinking and they're not getting their head beaten in. I'm going to actually take it easy tonight myself. And if you're willing to be that person, it's funny how you end up having people kind of become your friends just out of that ability to defy that group norm, if you will.
Now, let me cover a rather touchy subject here, Mitch. What about parents who want to consume some alcohol with their teenaged son or daughter to perhaps give them that experience in a controlled and responsible setting? And we do kind of see this all the time. Dad or mom gives their teenager a beer or a glass of wine on a special occasion, but we've also seen parents get arrested and convicted for endangerment for supplying alcohol to teenager parties.
You know, I'm from a religious tradition that uses alcohol in a lot of rituals, and so I feel like, you know, at a certain age, it's really okay for kids to have a sip of wine as part of some kind of ceremony. I don't see any problem with that at all. The key is there is absolutely no way you can provide alcohol for anyone else's underage child, period. It just cannot happen. And I like that law. I mean, that's there for a reason and a good reason. So any of this, oh, dear dad, would you please buy us some beer? We'll be your best friend. You're going to be the coolest dad in the town. Hey, you're going to be the coolest dad in the jail. That is just not going to happen in any kind of good way at all. And the bottom line is the reason that's a law is because people like that idea. Nobody wants to think that some adult is getting their kids all liquored up.
Now, Mitch, how about another aspect here? I mean, 43% of high schoolers drinking, that's a lot. Why don't we see more of a push within schools to try and educate and cut down on that rate? It seems so much of the focus is on marijuana use with teens these days, drug testing programs and the like, but why don't we see a bigger push, like a youth media campaign or something that specifically targets alcohol, saying kids don't drink?
What's funny is that trend is slowly starting to change. So I'm seeing more and more alcohol-focused intervention programs in the high schools, markedly more than there were, you know, in the 70s and 80s. And I think that that's really a step in the right direction because this is where all the negative consequences are. And this is a drug that's markedly more debilitating than cannabis. And I'm not saying underage people should go smoke pot instead because we've seen the data on that are also not very encouraging at all. I do feel like because parents drink alcohol, they get that argument from the kids of, well, you do it so that I can do it too. I assure you that that's just not a good argument. You know, I can use a chainsaw, but I don't want my five-year-old to use a chainsaw. I mean, there are all kinds of tasks that are really challenging that require a whole set of skills, and drinking alcohol happens to be one of them. I think if we're willing to go ahead and talk about that and not have to feel like, oh, I'm a hypocrite because I have a glass of wine once in a while, that's a completely different story. And you can actually model, hey, look, here's how somebody who's an adult has alcohol and enjoys it by, you know, having just two drinks and doing it on a full stomach and not chugging and, you know, all these kinds of things. And suddenly people go, oh, you know, in fact, alcohol isn't that big a deal. And I can see how somebody could use it without it turning into a problem. The other thing that's actually pretty compelling that I'm finding teens will resonate with is the data on how binge drinking alters neuropsych function and brain structure, really. So in heavy binge drinkers over the years, you really see meaningful deficits, big holes in their brain, if you will, markedly dramatic losses of brain structure over years and years of binge drinking. It's just not what, you know, we're designed to do. And suddenly teens will open their eyes if they see something like that.
I'm sort of back to the comparison here, Mitch. You know, you talk about the holes in the brain from, you know, consistent binge drinking. In even heavy cannabis users, is anything like that apparent?
We don't see any structural changes in adult cannabis users even after 2 years of daily use. In adolescents, there's one study that suggests that the proportion of white and gray matter changes if you're a heavy cannabis user early in life. Another study did not replicate that finding, and I have to be candid about that. But the haunting data for me are actually those Peter Fried data out of Ottawa that shows these declines in intelligence, these decreases in IQ test scores for folks who smoked 5-6 days a week for quite a bit of time early in life. So we got 15, 16, 17-year-olds who are, you know, smoking more days than not and end up having decreases in their IQ test scores, and that's just a real drag.
Now, we know binge drinking is a very, very dangerous thing to do. In the worst cases, it can be lethal. But if folks end up drinking, even say just, you know, one drink per day, is that going to be a health detriment?
In adolescence, we don't have compelling data, but at least as far as brain development is concerned, it just doesn't sound like a good idea. In adults, if you actually stick to two drinks or fewer per day, if you're a man, or one per day if you're a woman, the data are actually pretty compelling that it's harmless. The problem, of course, is after two drinks, a lot of folks say, well, what's two more, and end up creeping into the binge night after night, and then that really does take its toll on all kinds of health systems.
Now, let's touch on something else. I mean, we'll see this on the network morning shows even. The supposed hangover remedies, let's talk about those, or even pre-drinking hangover preventers, so-called. Many of these include over-the-counter analgesics, pain medications, or cocktails of weird herbs and energy boosters like taurine. So, Mitch, A, does any of that stuff work? And B, could some of the stuff actually do more harm than good?
These new over-the-counter hangover meds, if you read the instructions, they all say, take this before you drink, drink a big glass of water, and then don't have more than four drinks. Well, if you drank a whole lot of water and don't have more than four drinks, you're not going to have much of a hangover anyway, particularly if you space your drinks and just stay hydrated. So I wonder if some of these are placebo and we just don't have any data. Some of these other ideas of, you know, in the morning, take all these things and eat all these things and you'll feel better, that's just, you know, it's going to be rough no matter what. The real way to keep from getting a hangover is to stay hydrated and keep the amount of alcohol consumed to a minimum. And what a surprise, then you can actually have a really great time and not pay for it. And I would say, you know, under those circumstances for adults, you know, keeping it under two a day is absolutely reasonable.
Now, back to the comparison of marijuana and alcohol, should parents perhaps feel a bit better if they hear from their teenager that at a summer party last night they tried some cannabis as opposed to tried binge drinking?
Oh, it's an impossible comparison to make without getting somebody angry. The bottom line is the negative consequences to a real serious alcohol binge are markedly worse than even the most serious of cannabis binges, but the potential for something bad happening during intoxication is very high for teens no matter what, because they just don't have the experience doing all the things they need to do under those circumstances, so that's really rough. The other thing is, it's not that alcohol causes bad things or marijuana causes bad things necessarily, but often kids who are really involved with these things are also involved in a whole lot of other generally risk-taking or otherwise problematic behaviors. And so rather than, you know, saying, okay, now I'm going to ground you and keep an eye on you forever because of what you're drinking, you might say, hey, well, what was going on? Tell me what happened this day. Why do you think you ended up drinking so much? And often you find out things about your child's life that you didn't really know about. So there's, you know, a set of people who are good and a set of people who are bad. They're not particularly involved at their school. You find out their school is absolutely boring, they're unchallenged, they're smart, but they just can't get what they need. And it often uncovers much more important stuff.
Now, finally
about,
today here, Mitch, the ultimate
comparison
how
I want to get my child engaged in
we
life
know that there has
rather
never,
than just
ever
berate my
been
child
a death recorded
of
because of a
or
cannabis or THC overdose. Nowhere in the world has there been a marijuana overdose death. It's just impossible because of the non-toxic nature of marijuana. However, there are a disturbing number, and I mean thousands here, of alcohol poisoning deaths each year. Many of those deaths are young people. So how much alcohol can be a lethal
dose? As it turns out, the estimates for a lethal dose usually try to guess what's the lethal dose that would essentially kill half of the population. Well, the problem is I don't want to kill anybody. And so usually anything that's going to get you over the legal driving limit, this 0.08 blood alcohol concentration, is going to be rough enough for anybody to deal with. And so, no, it won't be lethal. And you know, I've had experienced alcoholics with incredible tolerance who can drink a fifth and nothing seems to happen to them. But that 0.08, which is about four standard drinks, you know, so it's really, you know, pounding four beers relatively quickly, That's going to do it. And I really don't want to see anybody go over that, because it's not necessarily, you know, you'll die of alcohol poisoning, but you'll, your odds of doing something stupid are really high. The other thing I want to mention is the hallmark of these alcohol poisonings is almost invariably drinking games. And everybody loves to have fun, but, you know, whether you're pointing your elbow or bouncing a quarter or whatever, the fact that anybody is consuming that rapidly and at someone else's command is always a bad idea. There's so many things you can do. You can play cards, you can write, you can talk, you can think, you can, you know, watch a movie. Don't get involved in a game where somebody else is in charge of your alcohol consumption. It's just idiotic. And those are the things that seem to be the hallmarks of these alcohol intoxication problems and the lethal poisonings.
Well, Mitch, this has been a very informative discussion here today. I want to thank you so much for taking all these questions on this topic today.
It's funny, before I wrote the marijuana book, I had literally a dozen years of alcohol research in my, you know, repertoire, and I'm always happy to discuss this topic.
Righto, Mitch. Many thanks again. Dr. Mitch Hurley-Wine joins us each Wednesday here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Mitch is professor of psychology at State University of New York, author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com.
Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.